remember what I said in my address. Part of what I hope happens today is an exercise in informing you as you do your sacred trust of electing a bishop in the Church of God. I wrote to all four of our nominees, and one of the things that I'm particularly happy about is there are only four nominees, which I believe says this diocese trusts Alex Campbell and the fine group of Christians that found our nominees. I wrote them and told them I do not and will not have a candidate. I will not exercise my right to vote at the electing convention. You will never be able to tell by the twitch of an eyebrow who I'm interested in as my successor. What I'm passionately interested in is that those of you who will be voting in that election know as much about this diocese as you possibly can. And it is the means to informing your discernment. We're going to have this panel. It's a wonderful panel we have. They are all, except for the old canon, who informs me that because she is solidly Gen X, in some ways she's no longer credible to speak about millennials, except she gives her whole life to them, so I'm going to think that she still has a modicum of credibility. The only other questionable person at the table, in so many ways, is Mitch. Apparently, it depends on which sociologist you consult to determine whether Mitch is in fact a millennial person or a Gen X. Sometimes we think he's a patriarch. Anyway, every other person on the panel is clearly a representative of that most interesting emerging generation of millennials. And so we look forward to hearing from them. I would like you to introduce yourselves, please.
I'm Amy Rio-Coltis. I'm the canon for college and young adult ministries. I work out of the cathedral and on the campus at the University of Louisville.
Hi, I'm Hillary Goldberg-Hyper. I'm a priest associate at Grace Church in Amherst, Massachusetts.
I'm Mitchell Wojcicki. I'm the vicar of Kansas.
I'm Matt Bradley, the director of St. John's in Murray and campus minister at Murray State University.
I'm Benjamin Hart, and I'm the chair of St. John's in Murray and the chair of the ministry at campus minister.
Hold the microphone closer to your mouth.
I'm Jennifer Delaney. I'm a recent graduate of Western Virginia as the peer minister for the Christ Episcopal Church.
Hi, I'm Ellie Gullett. I'm a student at University of Louisville, where I'm one of Amy Coates' minister E there and a peer ministry graduate as well.
I am so grateful for all of you for doing this. I know it's kind of amazingly intimidating, but don't let it be. This group out here is a wonderful group of Episcopalians who are trying very hard to begin their discernment process about the Episcopal election, and they are grateful you're here, I know. I have a question to begin, and that is, what do you cherish and what do you value about your Episcopal identity? This is what's called dead sound. I think you're going to begin.
What I cherish most, perhaps, about... Can you all hear me, by the way? Yeah. Okay. What I absolutely love and cherish about being a Episcopalian is the... embracing acceptance of our church. Having come to U of L, I had a period where I went to many different other churches, denominations, even from different faiths, but I came back to the Episcopal Church because of this acceptance, this tolerance where we have people of different extreme views, but we're all here in communion. And I, as a Christian, I feel like Episcopalians are truly working for that vision of God's kingdom on earth. The red doors are open. You know, we are, regardless of, you know, race or color or class or any of those other things that can be barriers, that we truly do seek to look beyond that, and that we worship all together, you know, in the same liturgy. And I love that communion and reaching across all those boundaries, just like Christ. So,
I have to agree with a lot of what she meant with the commonalities in the service. I participated in two national EYE youth events and one provincial youth event, and my favorite part was that everybody from all over the country and even different countries came together, and we all had that common liturgy. We all just go right into the service together at the same time.
I cherish our tradition of engaging the scriptures as a community. That we don't just leave it to those who we feel are more worthy, that we are all the baptism called the scriptures.
I think what I cherish most about the Episcopal Church is that while it's not a place where you can go to find easy answers, it is a place that you're welcome to bring difficult questions. And that you don't have to come to the answers to those questions before we get there. You don't have to have a set pattern of life before you walk through the doors. You're allowed to come as you are and to be formed into a Christian in community, in a community that worships together, that lives together, that holds one another up, and that is deeply and prayerfully engaged in the study of scriptures and in how we live those out in our lives.
What I share most is our connection to the tradition of the church. The prayer book is such a phenomenal resource to connect us not only to other Anglican traditions around the world, not only to previous generations of the prayer books and other Anglicans throughout history, but truly back through the Middle Ages and even before that into the earliest parts of the church. We are connected and worshiping with all the saints who have gone on before. I truly believe that if St. Augustine came back, he would recognize our worship as valid Christian worship, and it would look familiar to him.
So, building off a lot of what everybody has already said, I guess what I value most, and first and foremost, is that it's a Christian community, and that at our very core, we proclaim the good news of Christ crucified and risen. And that is just kind of our very center. And then what specifically about the Episcopal Church that I love and has continued to draw me to it is that it provides the liturgical and theological tools to think about what it means to live that good news, both as an individual and in community. And you have the history of the prayer book and the traditions and the way we approach scripture. And I love that. It has continually drawn me to the Episcopal Church, so much so that I decided to work in it.
I affirm everything that all of these people have said. Enough that I would need to go first if I don't have anything. So in addition to all that, I would say that I value the middle way of Anglicanism, and maybe not just the historic understanding of that, the coming together of Catholics and Protestants, but goodness gracious, the world needs to be able to figure out how to come together and find a middle way. We don't seem to be able to get much done right now in the country. I think a lot of us have talked about that while we've been here. And somebody needs to be able to show that finding a place in the middle can be life-giving and can come up with creative solutions to how we live together and still maintain difference, and how we live in respectful dialogue together. So I value that about ISD.
I would like to ask another question, and that is with some real specificity, and the question is this. What do you wish the church did more effectively? And anybody that wants to go first can go first.
Well, I know that the clergy portion of this was also asking what are some of the frustrations in the frankly, what I wish to be more effective was to figure out ways to fund the young adult ministry. I'm a very interesting, I'll have to be more spiritual answers to that. Come next January, I don't know who's going to pay my salary. I'm fortunate to be in a diocese where we have strong support for campus ministry. It saves about the third of a package of a clergy person. But the rest of it is made up for some diocesan grants, so again, I'm lucky there. But the rest of it is funding that Mark and I have had to go to the National Church, to some foundations to look for, and that takes up a lot of time. I'd rather be spending that time hanging out with Ellie having lunch. When I have lunch with Ellie, she makes my lunch. I would rather be doing that. I would rather be having some compliment at the cathedral in conference every night than filling out paperwork after paperwork about why someone should think how great I am and give me $15,000 more to do the work. So that's what I wish.
So, for me, I think what I wish or find most frustrating is, like I just said, this is a church that I think is centered on the basics of, Christ and Scripture and the good news. But I find often, especially as a young adult and working with young adults, that kind of gets lost. There's all of this other stuff that I find, like social justice things, and we lose sight of why we do that in the first place. And the foundation. And I also get a little frustrated with the idea of church on a business model and success being about numbers. And, if you're not getting I didn't get a medal for that. That's right. Well, and I think that's something that generationally it's not. I mean, success and numbers don't fit together with me. And if I only have three people at my young adult Bible study, if I'm helping to form three really solid Christians, that means more to me than having 20 people who just are kind of there for, social or if they're checking off their church box for the week. I mean, it's about really intentional community. And sometimes that's small, but that, to me, it's fine. It's just hard when you're trying to justify this kind of ministry to others. When you're like, well, that's great, but our Sunday school has 50 people, so you need to focus on that instead of your 30, 20-year-olds who come on and say,
I think that frustrates me currently, and it kind of ties in, I think, to what Tony was saying, is I feel like I'm met with resistance to being Episcopal in a lot of different, many very subtle ways, but there's a lot of pressure because there are non-denominational churches and mega churches that are growing, although I think the last research I've seen about that is that they're not growing anymore, they've stalled out. But because for a long time they were the big point of growth, there's a lot of pressure for us to change our way and be more like them. And that is tremendously frustrating to me because I think what we have in the prayer book may be the greatest resource in Christendom. And to try to hide that or to be ashamed of that and to try to shape ourselves to be like something else because we're afraid the numbers aren't there is tremendously frustrating.
I think part of it is one of the things we need to be able to do as church is to shift from a model of recruiting lay volunteers to get jobs done and switch to a model of developing members
into disciples. And what I mean by that is giving folks language and understanding so that it breaks out of the four walls of the church. And your Christianity permeates the way you live your whole life. And I don't think you do that well. I don't think that we empower, that's a trite term, but it's the best I've got. We don't give people their discipleship. We have them looking to the clergy for answers, to provide programs, and to start ministries. When the impetus should come from the lay, and the reason people come back to us for it is because we just buy into. When people come and ask us, I think we should start something, say, great, I've got Tuesday nights free, we'll do that. And I think the way we talk about caring for burnout in our congregations reflects that. We tell clergy that we need to talk about something. Because the clergy often wind up starting things, and we burn ourselves out, and it's just a stupid model because we've got dozens, scores of really competent Christians that just need the go ahead, to go ahead, to go ahead. Frustration, and this is just, this is a hard nut to crack. We're going to have to crack it. We're going to figure out how to grow our churches. And that is that unlike any group in the world that is affected, we expect our employees to do multiple full-time jobs, and then we wonder why they don't do anything well. And that's the lay and clergy alike. And I'll speak for myself personally. I'm a one-third time campus minister and a two-third time rector, and every week I feel like I'm doing a bad job at both of those jobs because I can't do them well if I can't do them fully.
To go back to your point, what Mitch said, I think we need to be known better in our community for what we are. For a group of Christians who have an open door, who everyone is welcome, and who are willing to deal with hard questions and not necessarily have the answers. And I realize that's the new word, but I think we need to do it more.
The original question that I do is what we do more effectively?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. My opinion, more the most effective thing to me would be to find some kind of group for my age range. I mean, I'm just a college graduate. I did stuff, from middle school on programming wise, and I don't even excel in programming, but with the Mulberry, who tried to start a group for young adults, and that got kind of overpowered by young 30s, which that's not my age range, and I would prefer to be able to. I would feel more comfortable if there was a place for me. I'm not married, I don't have kids, I don't fit in and feel comfortable in a lot of groups. So I feel like the best thing would be some kind of area for, even if it's just a group where they meet and have their own, half hour coffee, meet, whatever. So just some kind of programming where you're not alone.
As far as what church to do more effectively, in my experience, I agree with Jenny in that young adults, I mean, I'm in college, and I'm lucky enough to have Amy as a campus minister. And she has a young adult group, but of course, we don't know how long that will last if we can't find any money or whatever. But also, I do think it is really helpful to have a place where you can interact with your people of your age cohort. I would love to see opportunities for young adults and youth interaction with some older members as well. So, come to All Saints, volunteer, because that way we can get to know you all. You all have so much wisdom and experience that we can learn from that. And, I for one would love to hear stories and, advice and everything. So you really do care, and young adults do care what older people think also. So come meet us.
Thank you. There's several things I want to talk about. I think this convention needs to hear, and I know that several of our clergy have thought about it at some amazing research was just made public this week through the Pew Research Center on the whole religious attitudes of the millennial generation. And I think every Christian needs to know what the results of that data tell us. But I want to do a simple follow-up because I was intrigued by something Ben Hart said, and I would like to, I think the convention might be, if you don't know, I would be. You mentioned how the church helps you engage Scripture. Would you sort of describe your present engagement with Scripture and how you've been invited into that in the church you're a part of? How are you engaging Scripture now, Ben?
Well, right now I'm in the event, and we are constantly engaging both the Scriptures and the writings of theologians, and even in the church, when we have the readings, there's always someone in the congregation, probably our afterwards, that comes up and asks me, what do you think about the lesson, or about the letter, or about Max Sermon. I think it's a community that fosters that, that we need to cherish. Something about growing up in Sunday school, there was a little law written to make it hard to have easy answers.
Thank you. I think a lot of people in the room don't realize that EFM is for people in their 20s. Works real well as a way of engaging Scripture. That's probably an eye opener for someone.
Hello, everyone.
Well, one quick thing, but I think the law, you know, doing what we do is, what I found is, I just want to tell a quick story. I went to last year when I was interviewing for jobs, I had one interview committee, and they asked me all these questions, and at the end, one of the members said to me, she said, you know, you talk about Jesus an awful lot. We don't really talk about Jesus here. And I was just blown away. And I feel that, I mean, I get frustrated because I feel like we don't necessarily talk about Jesus a lot. And even Scripture, I mean, so many of us are like, oh, you hear something in Scripture, they're like, oh yeah, that's what the prayer book says. It's just returning to basics and not assuming that people know. I mean, baptisms, like young adults, we have to get over like the idea of evangelism as if I just live a really good life, people are going to come up to me and ask me why I live that way, and then I can talk about Jesus. We need to say to somebody who's sitting next to you who's interested, say, well, I really want you to come to me for something. I want you to come worship with me. Are you baptized? Do you want to be baptized? Like, just to ask. Young adults want to be asked. I mean, I've got families that are bringing little kids to be baptized, and they weren't baptized when they were little, and they're still not baptized because nobody asked them if they wanted to have their child baptized. And so it's changed. We can't just assume that people are going to come up and tell us they want to be baptized or tell us they want to come to church. We have to go out and just look at them and get over, you know, all of these preconceptions we have. Just say, you know what? I'm going to share Eucharist, which is the most important part of my being, and I want you to be a part of that. And I feel like the Episcopal Church doesn't do that very well, even when we have so much to offer. We just have to be open about offering it.
You'll win a medal someday.
I think that certainly from Gen Xers and older, we sort of think when young people show up, which usually means me, and I'm old, I'm only 35, 40 years old, show up, and you think those young people show up and they can't ask them to do anything because they'll reject you, which is true, kind of my age group. But this generation, that is not true of. Ellie, for example, went through our peer ministry program, which meant that for a year, while she was a full-time student, spent 2.5 hours a week being trained in how to mentor for her friends in their spiritual life, in their pastoral life, when they were in times of need. She spent 2.5 hours a week and then decided she'd spend the next year mentoring other students to do that. She didn't get paid for that. She doesn't have to watch occasionally with me for free, but then she also has to make me watch sometimes. Sorority has clearly spent a lot of time educating and studying. I know from talking with Ben and Matt and Mitch and getting to know Jenny, Ben's doing ESM. Having gone through ESM myself as a young person, it's not like it doesn't take a big commitment. And so this is a generation that when, especially if they show up at your door, give them something to do. Invite them to something. Don't say, oh, maybe they'll show up after a couple of months and we'll ask them to do something. Immediately engage them.
And don't assume that they necessarily want to do youth ministry. They say, hey, why don't you do the youth group? But not everybody is called to that ministry, and you have to be willing to say, well, maybe no, I want to be on the altar. So just try to branch out. You're 20-something, you're an adult, you can be on the altar, you can be on the altar. Don't just have to be youth ministry.
The other thing is, going that barrier for entry. We talk a lot about meeting people where they are. If you're trying to reach young people, do not downplay the importance of having a Facebook group for your church. If you don't know how to make a Facebook group, you need to learn how to make a Facebook group. It is not difficult. It takes 2.5 minutes. It is free. It is free advertising. And you tend to talk about relational leadership. That's how you reach people in my generation. You reach them through their friends. Facebook is a ready-built apparatus for them. The way it works, you make a Facebook group. You make an invitation for an event that you're doing at your church. You have London Book Studies event. We're meeting at this time. You post the event and you invite the people who are members of the Facebook group. Every person who confirms that event, it posts that they're attending this event at your church. What time it is, and the description of the event, a picture of your church. You can't pay hundreds of dollars to put that in the newspaper, but you're getting it in people's homes on their computers, and it's already endorsed by someone they consider their friend. You want to talk about low threat level evangelism? That's a great way to do it. It's comfortable, it's easy, and it lets people know that maybe the person they don't know goes to your church. How many friends do you have that you don't talk about your church? But if they saw that, they'd be surprised, and then they might be intrigued because you all share a lot of confidence. That's what it lets you do. And that's one of the many reasons.
I have a friend who teaches at her, she's in Harrison, Tennessee, and she teaches a faith group once a year, and she makes everybody in the room commit, who's on Facebook, regardless of age, commit to every Sunday morning putting on their Facebook, going to church, and then when they get home saying, this is great at church today, whatever particularly stood out to them. And eventually, people go, hey, maybe I'll be in church with you sometime, because exactly what you just said, he's giving you. So there's some statistics that I was going to talk about. The Pew Forum released this week their huge study on millennials. It's a huge comprehensive study. If you go to pewforum.org, you're free to download the entire study and read it. There was also, I think Jim Lehrer this week did an hour-long broadcast about it, so you can watch that online, which is what you would do if you're a millennial. You can also take the How Millennial Are You quiz and find out the differences between the generations. They have a 30-page report that is just about millennials and religion. And it goes through some lots of different questions, but I think the interesting things to talk about in that report are that there are some predictable things that they report at unaffiliated levels of religion higher than the previous generation, which is expected. What's unexpected in the report, and I'll talk about another report after this that I think is maybe even more helpful to look at, is that they actually report sort of a higher return to traditional understanding of Christianity, to the sort of essentials of the faith, which I think maybe my generation and maybe a few of you who are older than me have been fighting about some things that maybe they don't see as essential. And they want for us to talk about the essentials of being a Christian. And they report in some places levels of 10% higher engagement than the Gen Xers and Native Boomers on things like believing in the resurrection of Christ. Seems like kind of an essential of your faith to me. And they want to talk about that. They want to hear what we have to say about it, how we have experienced that, how that gives us life. They want to hear about that. I'm not going to go through all of their statistics. It's kind of a complicated survey, and they break it down from millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers, and the silent generation. And they go from the early 70s until now and break it down for statistics. And it's all online. They even have an appendix that sort of sums it up. So you can go through that and see some of the more interesting questions. There's also another study that I would invite you to look at, which was done through LIFEL, which is a research arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. It was done 2 years ago. And they break it down between talking to people who are unchurched and people who are churched. And one of the most interesting statistics are the pieces where they ask, what happens when you are churched growing up? What happens after that? What causes people to break away? And the first thing that I would challenge us as people who are already committed to the God of the parishes is that people who are 30 years old, whether they have been churched or unchurched, only at 50% reported having their parents take them to church at least twice a month throughout their entire childhood, from birth until 18. Only at a 50% level. So the first place for evangelism is taking your children to church. The next piece comes in at campus ministry. This is my favorite statistic, which again is self-serving. But in their study of 30-year-olds who are in churches still, reported that if between the ages of 18 to 22, they remained engaged by the church. So they had someone at church who was in communication with them, working with them, inviting them to worship, doing programming with them. If they had that constantly to the ages of 18 to 22, at the age of 30, they were 94% more likely to still be in church. So for everyone who's going to church from 18 to 22, those people who are engaged in our campus ministry, 94% of them will still be there when they're 30. And then they'll get married and have kids and they'll be hooked. I think that says a lot to us about the importance of funding campus ministry.
Huge.
Again, it's not
serving. You're not the only campus ministry, so it's not self-serving.
But there, in the rest of, they have some more specific statistics, but the places where LifeWay and Form overlap is that people report, just under 30 agers, report at about 72% self-report, wanting to have a deeper relationship with God, wanting to understand more about what faith means in your daily life. And then they go on to say that about almost 100%, 97% report that the major reason they fell away if they were engaged in church, the major reason they fall away is not over some doctrinal or political issue, but simply they had a life change and no one followed up with them. They moved, their family moved, and they just became disconnected. They went to college, there wasn't someone there to connect with. I think that
A little thing that I remember hearing from our campus ministers is how frustrating it is when they write the clergy in the diocese and say, please tell me the names of your students that are coming and they don't receive a response.
And more frustrating than that is when they go to the Diocese of Lexington or vice versa and they feel, those students feel like they don't have any point of engagement. So you have young adults who went to camp, they hear great stories from the domain like you do from All Saints, and they come here and we haven't developed a system for them to go, hey, I'm in this community just as much as I am in Kentucky as I am in Lexington. That is very, very frustrating. I'd like to work on that as well. Just a couple more statistics to point out what said about small communities with young adults. 70 in the LifeWay study, 73% of young adults report that having community with other young adults is extremely important for the language that they use. Being able to see someone who looks like you, who's also engaged in the same questions, gives you a little bit of security, is what I heard you saying about that. Some of the quotes that I hear over and over that LifeWay also reported is that I graduate, and then the church says, well, I'll see you when you have kids. And I actually think that explains a lot of the gap that we see. And so instead of feeling maybe like, young adults have rejected us to say, wait, we were using a model where people got married and had kids when they were about 20. Well, I'm 34 and 7'8". I don't have kids. So if the church was waiting for me to have kids, where would I be? And I think that gap just gets wider and wider. If we don't figure out a way to engage people in that in-between time, which just needs to keep increasing, we're going to lose them. They say, I'm in the middle. I'm not a youth. You don't see me as an adult because I don't have kids. So I'm in the middle. And they call it, in the last study, they heard over and over again people saying, I'm in the of stage. So I'm like, oh. Everything changes all the time. I have to move again. I have to figure out how to pay for this kid. I have all this debt piling on. Everywhere I turn, there's uncertainty. And isn't that a place where the church can step in with some certainty, some rootedness, and offer a home for them? Offer some community, offer some family, offer some answers. It's not 1170,
you should probably ask that. 1170. Yeah, the last question is all multifaceted, so it's open-ended enough for anybody to buy in any place. And that is, has the church asked enough of you? In what way have you felt valued, and what gifts have you given? Has the church asked enough? In what ways have you felt valued, and what gifts have you given?
Wow, big question. One way in which I have really felt valued and seen my gifts and used in church, in the physical church, is when I come up with an idea for like a fundraiser to raise money for the people of Haiti. And I thought, wow, I really want to do something with contemplative prayer. And so I told Amy about it. And she said, oh, great, I love that idea. Let's have a cathedral. And I can help you make flyers. And, maybe we can come to the convention and we can talk about it, which we're doing right now. So you all know that you have flyers on your table. If you don't, you will soon. So please come up and talk to Amy or I afterwards if you would like to.
It's a prayer of
God. It's a prayer of God. That is right. Like you have to sponsor people for a marathon, to run. Well, prayer of God, it's just as requires just as much endurance for, to spend time in contemplative prayer in silence, the tagline, the day of silence for Haiti, that we would spend time together in community, whether you come to Global Christ Church Cathedral or, spend time in your home, your office, or with other people in your diocese, to spend the time, whatever form of prayer that you feel that you connect best. And that we would sponsor people for $5 for 30 minutes of prayer, and that money would go to physical relief and development. So that vision that I had, the idea that Amy nurtured, was one way in which I really felt, I really can do this. They do want me to be involved. I don't have to, have kids or be, have a degree, but I can, actually do this. It was very, it was, to use Matt's wonderful language, it was very empowering for me as well. And then just to go completely through the question, another way that, most wonderful way that has been tremendously amazing, honestly, in my life has been being a camp counselor at All Saints, the Episcopal Conference Center, this summer, and then having gone there, being as a camper throughout my life, having had counselors change my life, meeting with other Episcopalians my age has just formed my identity and just honestly enriched my relationship with Jesus and with God to such a broad, deep extent, and it continues to do so. And I think one of the best things about All Saints and being a counselor that being a young adult or in high school lets you do is that not only do you get to spend time with younger children and help mentor them, which is just a wonderful gift in itself, but you also get to connect with your fellow young adults, your fellow people of your cohort, and you get to see different views of Episcopal priests and older volunteers that come and help. Like I got to talk with Candace Lesher, who's wonderful, and Jen Tremble, and Mark Linder, and I never would have gotten a chance to meet these people and hear their visions of the church and hear how God is moving in their lives and have them challenge me and, you know, make me think even more so about what it means to be an Episcopalian if I hadn't had that space and that time and that opportunity to do so. So thank you all.
Thanks.
That's a great answer, Kelly. Thank you.
Oh, wait, there's a bit of an announcement that has to be made. It's amazing we live in a world with realities. This is Explorer with Hardin County plates. Is there a car alarm just going off? Sorry.
You may continue.
No, that's not a problem. I think my answer to this question is kind of double-sided. When I was in school, high school, middle school, college, everything, I was asked a lot because I was in a more defined group. I was I'm one of the kids that she said I grew up in the diocese of Lexington, and I was the main youth. I was a camp dean and camp counselor and all sorts of stuff. And the only other people that I've known that done that are my friends that I brought with me. And so that kind of crossover, I mean, I go to Augusta a lot doing that kind of stuff, and I love every bit of it. But now that I've graduated college, I just don't know where to go from that. I'm so used to being involved in tons of things, but now I'm just kind of, all right, what else is there for me?
I think where the Episcopal Church has asked the most of me is just by taking me seriously when I say, I'd like to do all three of those, or I'd like to do EFN or any of the number of things, and say, okay, I'm going to do it instead of the graduate youth ministry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like the church probably does that enough for me. But the reality is that you have young clergy up here, and we go in and we do things with the church. It's very incredibly gifted young people. Aren't they acceptable? No, we're not acceptable. We're just young people. We do this because we're young. There are lots of young people who can do just as much ministry for the church as any of us can, and they aren't because we aren't asking. It's because we have this idea that maybe we don't ask you to do ministry in the church until you have kids. And then we ask you to do things. And we invite you, to lead Bible study. And, what have you? We can ask more. It's just we don't know how to ask because we haven't had young people doing things in church. And so there's no model for them to follow there. There's no sign to give yes. Now we're not going to be expected to do it. I think that a lot of churches, usually the facilities of the right 13, J2A, young adult church piece. In most of my experience, the young adult church piece falls apart because that component revolves around getting young people engaged in ministries in the church. That's because a lot of those ministries in the church are done and are done in a way that is conscious. Pathways who are older and who have been doing that ministry for a long time. I'm also Jewish growing up in the church that you had to have seniority to roll meatballs at the church. It feels like that for altar girls. Don't think you have to ask a 20-something woman to do altar meal and a 20-something male to be unwilling to do rabbis. Find out what they like and then have them do it. If you've got a young person who's a Spanish major, maybe you need the Spanish language ministry in your church, and maybe it's the person who needs to do it. I'm going to say there are lots of people, and tons of issues that all the people are running. And the other thing that doesn't work for 20-somethings, 20-somethings don't respond well to the way that so many generations for a time in the world, that was fine, which is you put up a list in the parish hall, you ask people to sign up and volunteer, it's that relational piece that's missing there. No one feels a relationship with the sign up sheet. But if you come up to someone and say, you know, I'm going to do that in this area, and you would really love it if you would help us in this ministry, we'll get them, and we'll keep coming back to do it.
Just a just to piggyback on that a little bit, I think the relational piece is very important, and I think what often stops us is a lot of times we won't recognize what gifts young people in our congregation have. We feel like, well, I don't really know them well enough. I don't know what gift they bring. And so I don't know if I want to ask them to do X, Y, or Z, because I don't know if that's really what their gifts are. Well, ask them. I bet they know what their gifts are. And if you have a need in the church, and you say, you know, would you be interested in doing this? I think you might be good at it. And they say, no, I know I wouldn't be good at it. I don't think I want to do that. Find something else to ask them, because that doesn't mean they don't want to help at church. That means they know that they wouldn't like and wouldn't be good at what you just asked them to do.
Well, everybody articulated pretty well what I was going to say, which is really just that asking. I feel like the church is asking of me because, partially because it's a great diocese, they're kind of relentless in, you know, making sure I was doing stuff. But then, I also got to a point where I just wanted to be, so I made sure that I was, you know, put in place, like, positioning myself so people would ask me. But then, you know, when I moved, my now husband and I, even when I was in seminary, we'd be going to church, and we'd have people say, you know, welcome, and then we'd leave. Nobody else would talk to us. And I'm a seminary, just going into church and going out, nobody has any idea. And there are other 20-somethings that I would see in these parishes, and we would all, you don't want to stick around for coffee hour, because it's just coffee hour. And you don't know anybody, and we would just leave, and all of these 20-somethings would leave, and it just blew my mind. I'm like, here, I mean, you know, whatever, I'm a seminarian, and of course I want to give things to the church, and not a single person would ask me. We were going to this church for months. And so it's just a matter of just ask people. And do things like the most useful gift I got from my ordination was a Starbucks gift card. Just to take somebody out and say, hey, let's go have some coffee and talk. And I just want to know about you. And building those relationships. And it's slow, and it doesn't involve tons of numbers. But, I mean, if you can get one person to proclaim the gospel, is that better than, like, 30 people who just come on Sunday and then go home and don't say anything about Jesus in their lives? I mean, you know.
I just want to say a couple something that I wanted me to point out. So there's good news in all of this too. If we were having this discussion in some other denominations, we'd be talking about the emerging church movement. And some of this is in there, this relational evangelism, this relational kind of community. The good news for Episcopalians is when we buy a book about the emerging church, the first half of it is explaining why you need to do more traditional worship in your church. Why you need to take down projection screens, get rid of the rock bands, and put up icons, and figure out ways to fake stained glass windows and make it look more gothic. The good news is, we already have all of that. We already have the Book of Common Prayer. A few years ago, lots of friends were involved with the Sojourn Church in Louisville, which is a Southern Baptist emerging church model that's been pretty successful. And I used to go some occasionally just to sort of experience it. And one night I went, and literally the entire liturgy was the Book of Common Prayer. I told the bishop, we shouldn't come to copyright. I keep telling these stories on Ellie, but so Transfiguration Sunday, we had our small Eucharist at U of L, and afterwards we were talking about how the Lent was going to start and what people were giving up, and Ellie said, ooh, it's going to be short for Lent. Does that mean we're going to see the Great Litany next week? Yes! We're going to talk about 200 students at U of L showing up for Ash Wednesday. Now, I'd like to say they were all just guys and all me, but that's also in conjunction with ex-medical partners, and I do that with.
That's part of what's wonderful about it.
That's part of what's wonderful about it. But 200 students who, in between the classes, seek out the interface center there in our ecumenical ministry to come and pray for God's mercy in their lives. And when I put crosses on the floor, like when they run in and they couldn't come to the liturgy because they clap both at 12 and at 2. But they come in and they say, could you pray with me and give me ashes? And I say, yes. And I do that and I put ashes on their head and tell them, remember you're going to die. And they look at me and they say, thank you. They live in this real world. They know life is hard. They want us to be able to engage them on those difficult questions.
I think that's the last word. I hope that you found that helpful as your discernment process begins. And I hope that when you come to June, that you will remember this moment and that it will, in the way that the Spirit wants it to, permeate your soul. Thank you, each and every one of you, so very, very much for this risky enterprise you engaged in so generously. Thank you. And we're now in a very precise 15-minute break.
15 minutes?
Wow.
Wow.
I can't get back in.
I don't know. I offered her my seat. I think we had another one that she...
Yeah.